In this lecture, I'm going to do a fair bit with Dirac notations and Dirac notation. And so I thought I'll give you a little bit of a review of the properties of Dirac notation, because maybe it was a little bit confusing at the end of last lecture. So Dirac notation is the same as bracket notation. Right. So if we have a state psi, we can represent that as what is known as a ket, which looks like this. And you can think of this as being a vector. And in particular, it's a column vector. And this ket has a Hermitian conjugate called a bra, which looks like this. And you can think of this as a row vector. And we can combine bras and kets into inner products and outer products to form C numbers and operators. So for example, the inner product of a bra and a ket looks like that. And I guess if we put them like that, you can see why they call it bracket notation, bracket. And usually we just leave one of these lines out. And so you can write it like this. And that's just going to be a complex number. And if we take the outer product, it looks like this. And that's going to be some operator A, and you can think of that as a matrix. Okay, so if we have a set of states labeled by this index I, and if all of these states form an orthonormal basis, then we can say that the inner product between these guys is going to be the Kronecker delta function of the indices I and j. So this means if I is different to j, it's going to be 0. So the overlap between orthogonal states is 0. And if I equals to j, then it's going to be 1. So the overlap between the same state is 1. And so now if we have two systems, A and B, and they are in the states psi and phi, we can write a composite system by taking the tensor product of these two. So we usually represent a tensor product by this cross with a circle around the cross. And then people get lazy, so sometimes they just leave this out and write it like that. And sometimes they get even lazier, and then they put these things in the same ket. And even lazier than that, sometimes people write it like that. But all of these things are just the same thing. So whenever you see that, you don't need to think of them as being different. Sometimes people are nice and they put subscripts on the kets. But this gets really cumbersome, so if people leave them out, you just need to keep track of you know, what's on the left and what's on the right. Okay. And so as I showed you, I think, in yesterday's lecture, we can also construct density matrices. So for example, if we have the pure state psi, we can take the outer product of that state to get the density matrix. So we would get something that looks like this. And we can also figure out density matrices of composite systems. So for example, rho AB. Look like that. So we'll just insert that expression for psi in here. Or another way that you can construct a composite system is to just work out the density matrix of one of the systems and then take the tensor product of those. So we could write the tensor product of the two density matrices, which is so you can see that this thing is equal to that thing. And I think that may have been a little bit confusing in yesterday's lecture. But if you can just move this over there and put in a tensor product, and then the same thing. Okay. All right, so for this lecture, I wanted to talk a little bit about measuring expectation values of density matrices. So, so in the previous lecture, I gave you an example of a density matrix that was a mixed state, and it looked something like this. So here we've got an electron that's in an, we call this an incoherent mixture of up and down. And so I can write this density matrix down, but what happens if somebody actually prepares a state, a system in a state like this in the lab? And I would actually like to learn something about this, this electron in the lab. If I have many copies of this thing, I can measure expectation values of this state and then learn something about the density matrix. So, for example, I could measure the expectation value of some observable, like one of the Pauli matrices. So we'll calculate that here. Before we do that, let me give you the Pauli matrices in Dirac notation. So the identity, which is not really a Pauli matrix, but we lump them all together. The identity is given by this. Okay, so am I going to be interested in calculating the expectation value of sigma z? So in the first lecture, I showed you that if you want to calculate the expectation value of some operator, like the momentum operator, you put it in between two wave functions and then integrate over x. But we can generalize this to the density matrix picture. And in this picture, the expectation value of some operator A is going to be given by the trace of this operator and the density matrix. And so if you have something simple like, let's say the operator was something like that, then the expectation value can be written in a simpler form like that. But in general, we can express it in terms of this trace. Okay, so let's calculate the expectation value of sigma z for our state rho 1. So we've got the trace of sigma z times rho 1. And then we can use the linear properties of the trace to split this up into the trace of minus the trace. Yes?
I'm a little confused about what you wrote on the first part of that part, where the expectation value of A is up A up. Should that be a row number? Or is that row?
Sorry, I was, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Good, good, good. Yeah, so I guess you can go the other way as well. If rho is, let's say, a pure state, then the expectation value be like that. So here I've applied the trace to this whole thing, and then you can turn that into the trace of just this guy and the trace of that guy multiplied by rho. Okay, and then we can use the cyclic properties of the trace, which mean that you can you can permute all of the operators inside the trace, and this is something you guys are going to prove in the tutorial. But we can use the cyclic properties to write and now, since this thing is going to be just a complex number, and that's just a complex number, we can drop the trace because the trace of a number is just that number. And so now here we've got this the state rho just sandwiched between a bar and a ket. For the state up. So you can see if we act a bar on this side that's up and a ket on this side that's up, this thing's just going to go to zero. So the only thing that we're left with is this, where the inner product between a ket up and a bar up is going to be equal to one. And then if we want to evaluate this guy, we act the bar and ket with the arrow pointing down. And so this makes the first term go to zero and this thing go to one. And so we're left with a quarter. And so the expectation value of sigma z here is going to be equal to a half. Okay, so as I mentioned before, this state rho 1 is a mixed state. It's in an incoherent mixture of the state up and state down. But what happens if we consider a pure state that's in a coherent superposition of being up and being down? So I can define a state that looks like this. Now that's a coherent superposition. And I can write down the density matrix for this state, which I'll call rho 2. And we do that by taking the outer product of the state psi. And then if I insert this expression in here, I get three quarters up, up. Plus root 3 on 4 up down, plus root 3 on 4 down up, and a quarter up, up. And so you can see that this first term of this state and the second term of the last term of this state are the same as these terms here, but you've got these additional cross terms. And so typically these things are called coherences. Because they tell you about the fact that you've got a coherent superposition. Yes, Ilya?
Should those last two be down, down?
Yes, thank you. Okay, so we can again calculate the expectation value of sigma z for this state. We don't need to go through all of those steps again, but we can just infer from here what this would look like. So we would have up rho 2 minus down rho 2. And you can see that if we have up and up acting from the left and the right, these terms are going to go to zero. So the only things that are going to be left is this term and that term, and they're going to behave in exactly the same way as we had for this state here. So we get 3 on 4 minus 1 on 4 equals a half. So this is really interesting because you've got two very, very different states. One is an incoherent mixture, and the other one is a coherent superposition. Yet if we make this measurement of the expectation value of sigma z, we're going to not be able to distinguish between them in the lab.
So a
coherent superposition is anything that can be written as a linear superposition of pure states. And an incoherent mixture is when you write them as density matrices and then add them together. So you can have states that are kind of somewhere in between, but the two extremes are going to be this incoherent mixture or this coherent superposition. Okay, so we've shown here that we've got these two very different states, but if I measure the expectation value of sigma z, I can't distinguish between them in the lab. So what could I do to distinguish between them? Is there a different type of measurement that I could make? No.
Measure in the psi basis?
In the which basis?
In whatever basis, well, in some other basis.
Yeah, exactly. We can measure in some other basis. So. I'll show an example where we measure in the sigma x basis. So let's try sigma x So now, again, using the linearity of the trace, we get up, down, row 1, plus the trace of down, up, row 1, which looks like that. And then if we act from the left and the right on this state, we find that we get 0 plus 0, and that's equal to 0. But now if I do it for the other state, even though the terms here that correspond to the mixed state that we have here, they're going to go to 0, but we find that these terms in the middle are not going to go to 0. So what are we going to get? Okay, so that's very nice. We've got a technique for being able to distinguish between these two different states. If we prepare them in the lab. Yes?
Sorry, I'm a little confused. Why do you call bases the Dirac matrices?
Why do I call what the Dirac matrices?
Bases?
The bases?
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure.
I mean, I get that you are finding the expectation value of these matrices, but I'm confused.
So are you confused about the terminology or why,
yes,
why we're doing it?
Wait,
the Dirac notation just refers to using bras and cats.
Yeah, this one or something.
Yep. And so the Pauli matrices, are you worried about the Pauli matrices?
I mean, it's just for me that the basis would be the cats up and down, right?
That's one basis. That's the up-down basis. But we can define different bases as well. Are you confused why I'm saying the sigma z basis or the...
Mm-hmm.
Or the, oh, okay. All right. So when we make a measurement, let's say a projective measurement, we describe this in terms of measurement operators.
Mm-hmm.
And so we usually define a set of measurement operators with the subscript m. So if I say that I'm measuring in the sigma z basis, it means that I'm using measurement operators that are the eigenstates of sigma z. So they're going to be like this. And this will be like that. But now if I want to measure in the sigma x basis, the eigenstates of sigma x are written down like this, where plus or minus cap is. Like that.
Okay, so it's just the basis of your measurement operator.
Exactly. Yeah, so sigma x basis means I'm measuring these three operators. And then the expectation value is going to depend on this.
Thanks.
Okay, so I showed you here that if we have two very different states, if we choose the wrong measurement bases, then we're not going to be able to distinguish between them. But if we choose the right measurement bases, then we will be able to distinguish between them. But if you don't know anything about the state, it's not always clear what basis you should choose. So ideally what you would like to do is to be able to reconstruct the entire density matrix rather than just, you know, measuring some expectation value. It would be nice to know what the complete representation of the state is. And so the technique that we use to reconstruct a density matrix of a state that's prepared in a laboratory is called quantum state tomography. And so in this section, I'm going to switch back to matrix representation rather than Dirac representation because it's a bit more intuitive. So it's nice to go back and forth between these two representations because some problems are easier to work with in terms of matrices and some problems are easier to work with in terms of bracket notation. But so to do this, I'll define the states. I'll spin up and swing. Down to be these column vectors. And just to remind you of what the Pauli matrices look like in the spaces and the matrix representation. So along with the identity of Pauli matrices form an orthonormal basis for a density matrix, which means that we can decompose any density matrix in terms of a linear combination of these matrices. So it's a sum over all four matrices with some coefficient aj, which, if you don't know what rho is, it's undetermined. So in matrix form, we can write this as a0 plus a2, a1 minus that plus ia3. And you can see that in order for this to be a physical density matrix, so that the trace of this matrix is 1, we require that A0 is equal to 1. So then if we prepare some sort of density matrix in the lab, and we would like to reconstruct it, our goal becomes to identify what these other three parameters are, AJ, A1, A2, and A3. And so if we invert this matrix, or invert this equation, we find that the parameter AJ is equal to the trace of the related matrix times the band density matrix. And we saw before that this is just the excitation value of this Pauli matrix. And so now if we want to completely reconstruct the state, all we need to do is measure the expectation values of the three Pauli matrices, and then using these coefficients, we can put it back into this equation and reconstruct rho. Oh. Sense. If we look at the block state representation of the quantum state, the block sphere representation, we can plot any two-dimensional quantum system on a three-dimensional sphere. So let's say if we take this state psi is equal to cosine theta up plus e to the I phi. Theta down, then on this three-dimensional sphere we find here on the surface of the block sphere. And so this angle here is going to be equal to phi. And this angle from the z-axis is going to be equal to theta. Okay, and so this is a pure state, so it lives on the outside of the block sphere, but we can also represent mixed states on what's called the block ball, so that means they're going to live below the surface of the block sphere. And so the reason that I say that this makes sense is because measuring the expectation values of some state is simply making projections onto the x, y, and z axes of this block sphere. And if you've got the x, y, and z coordinates at some point in three-dimensional space, then that point is going to be completely defined. And so I guess this also gives you an idea of why it's called quantum state tomography. So the word tomography comes from medical imaging, so like CT scans, which stand for computed tomography. And these scans, they measure two-dimensional slices of, let's say, your brain, and then they can reconstruct a three-dimensional image from these two-dimensional slices. And so here what we're doing is taking slices through Hilbert space, and then using these slices we can reconstruct the state of the density matrix. Yeah, we might finish this lecture super early because I'm on to the last part. But before we go on, maybe are there any questions about this, any of this notation, the expectation values or the direct notation? Yes.
So you said we wanted to have rho have trace one.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that if we want it to be a pure state or? The
no.
purity test was for it to have trace one.
No, so the purity test is that rho squared equals one.
Oh, okay, cool.
So rho equals to 1 is a statement about the probabilities adding up to 1. So for any density matrix, let's find a density matrix. Oh, well, let's just draw one here. The probabilities of getting, if you're measuring in a particular basis where you express the density matrix in that basis, then the probabilities of getting certain outcomes are just the diagonal elements of this matrix. And so then if you add up all of the outcomes of a measurement, you require them to add up to 1. Yep.
So let's see if I got the idea right. The idea is to reconstruct rho given a whole ensemble of guys that
right.
are in the same state.
That's correct.
And then at that point, you're saying, okay, we should measure a whole bunch of them in sigma x, bunch of them in sigma y, bunch of them in sigma z, and then you get the block vector.
That's correct. Yep. Yeah. So implicit in this whole conversation was that to measure the expectation value of a particular state, you need to make measurements over and over and over again. You can't just measure the expectation value on one particular state. So you have to prepare many copies of that state. Actually, so can anyone think of how you would measure the expectation value of, say, sigma z?
If it's an electron with a bunch of passive through Stern-Gerlach's of different orientation.
Yep. And then what do? After you pass them through the Stern-Gerlach? Okay. So let's see what's going on. So we've got some sort of magnetic field, non-uniform magnetic field, and an electron comes in, and it's going to split up into two.
So
well, one or the other, and then what?
Bunch of population going up, some
yep.
of it going down, so you get yourself your expectation value. Because
and
expectation value is some of the probability times the outcome being spin up or down.
Okay, so we've got some number of electrons that go up here. It's going to be n up, and some that go
divide that by the total number?
Divide by the total number. Okay, so we want the difference between these two, right? So n. And that's going to be like that. Yep. Okay, and then to measure sigma x and sigma y, you would orient this Stern-Gerlach in some other direction. Okay, could you get away with measuring if we're saying that the sigma z, sigma x, and sigma y measurements correspond to different physical orientations of space, could you get away with measuring expectation values of different operators rather than just sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z?
As long as they're linearly independent.
As long as they're linearly independent, that's right. Yep. So then this thing becomes a little bit more complicated. You need to find a relationship between the measurement results that you have from the measurements that you make and also these expectation values of sigma j. But that's just simple linear inversion. So maybe we'll do that on the tutorial, but I don't know if we'll have time to do that. Okay, so for the last part of the lecture, I wanted to do something fun. And I think the most fun thing to do is quantum teleportation. So you're laughing, has everyone seen it? Who's like done the derivation for quantum teleportation before? Okay, that's like 5 of you. Cool. So this should be fun for those of you that haven't done it. Okay, so For quantum teleportation, this is typically the story that that we like to construct. So we have Alice. And let's say Alice is on the moon. So we need to draw a moon with some craters. So here we have Alice. And who's the second party in this game?
Bob.
Right. Do you guys know all of the characters?
Eve.
Yeah. And
there's a whole album.
Do you know Charlie?
Yeah, Charlie.
And then there's Eve, the guy Eve, spelt in the French way, but I don't quite remember what he does. But so usually Eve comes about when you've got when you're looking at quantum cryptography protocols. So Eve is the eavesdropper. Charlie is I think he's just the third party. But then you've got Victor as well. Victor's the verifier. And yeah, there's a whole cast of characters. But here we only have Alice and Bob. Okay, so Alice is on the moon, and Bob is here back on Earth. I'm going to draw. This is what I think Canada looks like. See, in Australia, it's easier. Australia's really easy to draw. But anyway, and we've got Bob. Bob's over at IQC. He's in his lab. And there's Bob at IQC. And Alice has got an electron that's in some particular quantum state, and she doesn't know what this state is. But she has it here, her electron, and it's in some state. And she would like to send this quantum state to Bob, but she can't do it because it's, you know, the electron's very fragile, so she can't just put it in a spaceship and send it to him. She also can't just measure the electron and, you know, tell Bob to recreate another electron in exactly the same quantum state, because she's only got one. And so we saw before, in order to reconstruct the complete state, she would need to make many different measurements on an ensemble of states. So she can't do that. So it seems that she's kind of lost. There's nothing that she can do. But fortunately, Alice and Bob were prepared for this situation, because before she left on her journey to the moon, Bob prepared a whole bunch of singlet states. So they were entangled states of two electrons. And out of this whole bunch, he gave her one of each pair so that she could keep these. And these electrons are also fragile, but because she had a lot of them, by the time she got to the moon, you know, a couple of them survived. And by the time it came, you know, to do this experiment, one of them was still around. So that's okay. Right. And so it turns out that she can use this entangled resource, this singlet state, as a resource for teleporting the quantum information back down to Earth. So what have we got? We've got our state psi here. And then we've got this pair of electrons that Alice and Bob share. And just, I'm going to like draw this wavy line, which is how we graphically represent entanglement. But I don't want this to be misleading to let you think that there's some sort of physical connection between these two. There's not. But just so that I can have something to refer to when I write down the singlet state phi, I'm going to draw this curvy line. Okay, so that's our graphical representation, but let's set the problem up a bit more precisely. So Alice has a state psi, which is in some arbitrary superposition of up and down, and she doesn't know what that is. And
Alice and Bob share this singlet state.
And so this first ket refers to Alice's electron, and the second one is Bob's electron. Alice's electron, Bob's electron. But there's only two electrons. So they're in a superposition of being in this state and in that state. And so another additional thing that Alice needs is she needs some sort of device that can implement a unitary operation on her two electrons. So on her state that she wants to send, as well as her pair from the singlet state. And the special unitary needs to be entangling, so it has to be something that entangles the two electrons. And so I'll write down what this unitary would look like. It's a bit of a mess, but we're going to need it in order to do the calculation. That's half of it, and then there's another half. This is usually much easier if you do it with ones and zeros, but I didn't want to swap notation on you again, so we'll leave it in terms of arrows. So we can see that this is an operator because it's got kets from the left and bras from the right. And do we have colors? Nope. Okay, so just to label these. So this is the first electron. So let's call this A1. And this is the second electron, A2. And I'm calling them A's because they're both electrons that Alice has. And this is A1 and A2. So what this means is that this bra is going to act on the second electron, and this bra is going to act on the first electron. Pardon me?
Doesn't she have one electron?
No, she has two. So she's got her state psi that she wants to teleport, but she also has another electron that's one of the singlet states, one of the electrons from the singlet pair.
Oh, she's.
So we've got three electrons.
Oh.
So yeah, so one is her unknown state, and then before she went up to the moon, Bob prepared a pair of electrons that are entangled and gave her one of them.
Bad.
Yeah. And so this unitary is only going to be acting on one of Alice on the two electrons that Alice has. It's not going to act on Bob's electron because Bob's electron is on Earth, so she can't do anything to it. She can only do stuff to her two electrons. And I mean, I'll walk you through the calculation when we do it, so don't be too scared by that. But just think of this thing as just being one like big ket, and this is one big bra. Okay, and then Alice also needs to be able to measure whether her electrons are spin up or spin down. Thank you. So if you're worried about this this unitary operation, it's just some sort of device that she has. Let's say it has some magnetic fields. Whether she sends her electrons through some magnetic fields or something more complicated than that. But essentially, it's just evolving the two electrons unitarily in a way according to Schrodinger's equation. So we're just applying a unitary operator onto this initial state. Okay, so she needs these things. The crucial part of this whole teleportation thing is that she needs to be able to call Bob and then tell him the results of her measurement. It's a very important thing. So Alice needs to tell Bob results of her measurements. And so the measurements I'm talking about is the measurements whether her electron was spin up or spin down. And then we need one more thing, and that's that Bob needs to be able to do some unitary operations on his electron, but they're very simple operations. They're just the Pauli-Z, acting the Pauli-Z matrices onto the electron. Okay, so is that story, does that all make clear, make sense before we actually do the calculation? Or do we want to ask anything else about it?
I don't understand. What does Alice have?
Alice has an electron that's in that state psi.
Okay.
It's in some arbitrary superposition of up and down.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if it was in an equal superposition of up and down, so if alpha was 1 on root 2 and beta was 1 on root 2, then you can think about this electron as having spin, you know, left. So rather than spin up or spin down, it's like spin left. And if alpha was 1 on root 2 and beta was minus 1 on root 2, then the electron would be pointing this way. It's just an electron pointing in some direction that she doesn't know what it is.
And is A1 and A2 are up and down, or what is...
So, alpha is a number?
No. The A1 you have for the
unitary. Oh, okay. So, right. So, we've got three electrons. So, we've got Alice's state psi, and Alice also has some of this entangled state phi.
Okay.
So, this is A1, this is A2, and this is B. So this unitary that I've drawn is an operator, and so I just wanted to symbolize that the first ket is going to be acting only on this electron, and the second ket is going to be acting only on this electron. Okay. So the first thing that we want to do is just write down the composite state of all of these three electrons. And that's very easy to do. We just take a tensor product of Alice's state psi and this shared state phi. So I've just labeled it by A1, A2, and B. And then, so that'll be Alice's state and a tensor product with this singlet state. And then I'm going to drop these labels because I don't want to keep writing them down, and I'm going to drop this tensor product, but it's implicit here. So just keep in mind that the thing on the left is A1, and then this thing is going to be A2 and A3. And so then I can expand all this out. So all I'm putting in is the state psi alpha plus beta down, and then the state phi, and then, you know, just expanding out the brackets. And I've again contracted the notation, but here we've got A1, A2, and B. Okay, so we've written down the state. Now what Alice has to do is apply her entangling unitary to just her two electrons. So we'll write entangling unitary. So we'll call the state after the unitary has been applied. We'll call that psi prime. And then we're applying the unitary on this state psi. So the reason I've got a tensor product here with the identity operator is because this operator is only acting on Alice's two electrons, and then we're doing nothing to Bob's electron. So this thing acts only on these guys, and that does nothing to that guy. But, you know, you want to keep your Hilbert space the same, so we have to insert this identity. And then, so I'll just write down the answer, and then I'll walk you through how we got to it. That's kind of yuck. But okay, let's have a look. So one thing that makes sense is, so if we act sigma, the identity on Bob's electron, we expect that that's not going to change for each of these terms. So you can see this is down, and it remains down, 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 up, up, this guy, and up. And let's have a look at this unitary. Okay. Okay, so now if we think about just Alice's second electron, you can see that the way to read this is that whenever Alice's electron is up, I'm going to replace it with an electron up. And when Alice's electron is down, I'm going to replace it with an electron down. When it's down, I'll replace it with down. When it's down, I'll replace it with down. So nothing's going to change to Alice's electron. Actually, is this going to work? No, I think we need to read these together because it's entangling. Okay. Let's forget that I said that. Okay, so if Alice's two electrons are both up, up, we're going to replace it with one of her electrons being up and the other one being in a superposition of up and down. So you can see here, Alice's electrons were up, up, and so I replaced it with one of them being up and the other one being in the superposition here. And let's say Alice's electrons are up, down, then I replace it with this thing being in a positive superposition and this being down. So here Alice's electrons were up, down, and I replaced that with this positive superposition and down. And I mean, all of the other, the coefficients and stuff stay the same. So all we're doing is just acting this operator here. And so we're only left with four terms, even though we've got something that starts off with four terms, and then we're multiplying it by something else that has four terms. You would expect you would get 16 terms, but a lot of these are going to go to zero because you'll have all of these inner products between orthogonal states. So the only thing that you're left with is something that has four terms like this. And so if that's not obvious to you, it's actually really worthwhile to just go and do this calculation in your own time. Because once you've done it once, then whenever you see people do it, it's like really quite obvious.
Are those kets A1 and B?
So there are three kets. You can imagine if you expand, this thing is actually, so it's up. Times up times down plus down times up times down. So each term really only has three electrons, and the electrons are labeled by A1, A2, and B.
So everything in the parentheses are A1s.
Yeah. So I've just collected terms here, so I didn't have to write everything down. So write too many things down. But yeah, everything here is A1, A2, and B. And it's the same all the way through. I was looking at my, there's this book by Michael Nielsen called Quantum Computing, Quantum Information. And I got this book when I was, quite young. Maybe I was doing my honors or something. And this is like right at the beginning. Oh, actually, I don't remember exactly where it is. But I looked at it yesterday just to remind myself. And I've got like in a little pencil written underneath all of these Brazen kits. I've got like A1, A2, A3. So I was totally confused by this years and years ago as well. So don't worry if it's confusing. Okay, so hopefully that'll make sense if you go through it once. Actually, the guy, Michael Nielsen, who wrote this book, he used to be at Perimeter, but now he lives in Toronto. He quit physics, and he's doing some nice stuff on how to do science in the modern age. So I recommend you finding his new books. Yep. Okay. So now we've done the difficult bit, which is acting the operator on the state. And I'm just going to rearrange the states. So it's going to look different, but all I'm doing is expanding this whole thing out and then collecting different terms. just have to make sure I have it right. Okay, so now we have this referring to Alice's first electron. That refers to Alice's second electron, and this is Bob's electron. So hopefully you can see where this is going. Okay, so now Alice has got two electrons, and she's going to make a measurement on each of them to see if it's spin up or spin down. So you can see that there are going to be four combinations. You'll have up, 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 down, down, up, and down, down. And these are represented here in the way that I've written out these terms. But the results of these measurements that she makes are completely random. She can't, you know, force this to go into one of these states. But she can make the measurement and then look at the results. So if we, let's say she measures and she gets the result that the first electron is spin up, spin down, and the second electron is spin up, then you can see that, maybe I need to tell you something. Okay, so the measurement operator that corresponds to this result is going to be it's going to look like that. So the way that you find out what the state after the measurement is that you apply this measurement operator to the state. So you can imagine if you apply this to this entire state, this whole term is going to go to zero. This term goes to zero, and this term goes to zero. And the only thing that you're left with is just a product of Alice's electrons being like this and Bob's electron being projected into the state that we started off with. So you can see that this corresponds to alpha down plus beta up, which is the state that Alice initially wanted to teleport to him. But it's not guaranteed that she's going to get this measurement result. She could get a different measurement result. For example, she could get up, up. And even though, so if she gets up, up, Bob's state is going to be projected into this thing. And even though they look pretty similar, like the only difference here is that there's, you know, a plus sign and a minus sign, they're actually very different states. And so specifically, if alpha and beta were one on root two, these states are completely orthogonal, so they're totally different. So this is not good. That's not what we want. But it turns out that if she gets this result, she can just call Bob up and say, hey, I got this result, so it means your state is like that. So all you need to do is now apply a unitary operation to your state. So if he has the state alpha down minus beta up, he just needs to apply, the sigma z operation, which is going to then turn this into minus alpha down plus beta up, which is minus the state that Alice started off with. But this minus out the front doesn't matter. It's just a global phase that you can't even measure. So effectively, for all intents and purposes, this is exactly the state that Alice started off with. And so you can do the same thing for these other measurement results. And so I'll just write down the table of what this would look like. Okay, so we saw if Alice gets down up, then Bob gets alpha down plus beta up. And then he doesn't have to do anything. You can say that he just applies the identity to his state. And then what he's left with is the state that Alice started off with. If he gets down, if Alice gets down, we get that state, so we need to apply the sigma x operation to it. And we get the minus of Alice's state, but this is just an, yes, Aisha? Sorry.
Sorry. The alpha and beta got swapped somehow, because originally we had alpha up, beta down.
Yeah, so that's the point. So the fact that they go,
minus side, but it's not minus side.
Oh, maybe I wrote this one down. Down. So we want this one y, and then that's going to be minus I. Okay, is that better? Yeah. Okay, so in any case, this again is just a global phase out the front, so it's undetectable. Or maybe there's no, I don't know if there's a minus. I can't
one,
do it in my head.
Is it fine with the alpha of beta down? And you have alpha down in the top of alpha.
Yeah. No. Here, that's okay because, you guys are good. I'm getting it wrong. Yeah, so maybe we need to work these out to make sure that they're consistent. Okay, so down was minus alpha up, beta down up was. Up, down is minus alpha up plus beta down, and up is alpha down minus beta up. Okay, so now we have to figure out again what the corrections are. Yeah, something's, I think possibly in here, something's gone wrong. Okay, so for this one, if we just apply the sigma x, then that swaps a down into an up and an up into a down. So then we get the original state side. This one is just the phase. Okay, so this one goes zero, and then we get minus psi. This one we want to swap. Okay, so alpha is corresponding to up, so that's fine, and beta corresponds to down, but we've got this minus sign out here. So I think we want to apply the sigma z, and that would give us minus psi. And here we need to flip the thing and add a minus sign onto it as well, so that corresponds to a sigma y. Do we have these written down? To save time, it's one of those. You can figure that out in your own time. Just like the one final thing that I wanted to say is that it's very crucial that Alice calls Bob up or communicates with him in some other way to tell him what the results of her measurement are. If she doesn't do that, then Bob doesn't know which of these terms it was projected onto. And so the only thing he can know about the state is what you would get if you calculated the reduced density matrix of Bob's state here. And this is one of the tutorial questions for you to calculate this. And what you'll find is that it's a completely mixed state. So without Bob receiving this phone call from Alice, he gets no information about the state that she had. Regardless of what she does on her side, he gets no information about this. And so this is the thing that kind of saves you, because at some stage people were concerned that having the possibility of entangled states kind of violated special relativity. So if you send these states, you know, to the other ends of the universe, if you make a measurement on one of them, it's going to instantaneously affect the other one. And people were really concerned about this. But what we see here is that even though this change to the other electron is instantaneous, there's no information that can be transmitted using this by measuring, you know, your local electron. So the transfer of this quantum information depends on the fact that you can send a classical message, you know, from one person to the other. And so then the speed of your communication is going to be limited by the speed of the light. Yeah, are there any questions about this? No? Okay, so I think, well, we're on time, even though we started late. So that's it for these lectures. And thank you very much for your attention. And I'll see you guys at the tutorial.